I've come to think of history as a living fabric made up of the lives of those who went before us and our own. History is personal. Here are lines from the obituary of my great-grandmother written in Iowa in 1910. She was born in Virginia, a slave. When 22 years of age, she escaped through the Underground Railroad to Canada and lived there until after the war when she settled in Muscatine. That would have made her part of one of the most remarkable undertakings in North American history. The Underground Railroad was a perilous migration through which thousands of African American slaves found freedom and new lives in Canada. In doing so, they lent their individual stories to the collective narrative of two great nations and enriched our understanding of the majesty of human sacrifice and triumph. My guest is Carolyn Smards Frost, author of I've Got a Home in Glory Land, A Lost Tale of the Underground Railroad. Carolyn, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. This book, among other things, is the fruit of a 20-year obsession, isn't it?
Very much so.
And a great deal of very painstaking research on your part. And let me hold it up because I want people to get a look at this fine volume. What we have at the core is the story of a remarkable couple, Thornton Blackburn and Lucy, mm-hmm. originally Ruthie, mm-hmm. his wife, and how they made their escape from Kentucky into Canada on the Underground Railroad. But Carolyn, to get us started, I think there's a lot more in here than that, rich as that is. And the two additional things, among many that I really was overwhelmed by, was this is a real depiction in my mind of the what racism amounts to when you see it in its ultimate form, that is human bondage, what it means to take human beings and own them, have them at your disposition for 24 hours a day and all of its cruelty. It's just remarkable, the depth of that kind of story that's revealed here. That and then something else, which I'd love to get you to comment on at the same point, the way in which Canada had to define its stance on these issues, both in terms of preserving its own principles, that is, anti-slavery, mm-hmm. and protecting its international position vis-a-vis its powerful neighbor to the south. Mm-hmm. So all those things, I think, are in this story as well.
I certainly tried to make sure that that was clear. I mean, one of the most important things about the book, I think, was the attempt to contextualize the story of these two people within the context of their times. It covers 120 years of North American history. Mm-hmm. Thornton Blackburn's mother was born near Manassas, Virginia in 1776. His wife died in Toronto in 1895. That is 12 decades of North American history on both sides of the border, and that shaped race and culture in modern North American society. So I tried very, very hard to contextualize them in every phase of their lives.
You know, I'm delighted with that answer, and let me relate to one of the Canadian aspects of what you've just said, how it shaped views of race and culture and of human rights. Mm-hmm. I think it's beginning in 1793, is it not, mm-hmm. that Canada is mm-hmm. Developing its anti-slavery stance far in advance of other parts of the British Empire. Mm-hmm. And this is a story that continues through the book. It does inspire a lot of many of the slaves who come north to Canada. I also began to suspect, Carolyn, as I read this book, and here's the question, is it also one of the strong roots of the Canadian Association with Human Rights that I feel is so evident today? In other words, that through its evolution of its position on anti-slavery and on being a place where slaves could come and be free, Canada also began to refine its own stance in terms of these other sort of 20th and 21st century issues.
That's a really interesting question. The whole concept of receiving fugitive slaves was one that was deeply embedded in the Canadian consciousness, but mm-hmm. I will not say that Canada was free of racism by mm-hmm. any means at the time. It was no promised land when people arrived there, and there was plenty of racial discrimination in the country. So I don't want to paint this in too broad a stroke there. But on the other hand, when the Blackburns arrived, they escaped during the first racial riot in the city of Detroit. They'd come from Kentucky. They were captured in Detroit. They were going to be sent back to their original owners, but the black community of Detroit and some of the white community of Detroit banded together and rescued them and got them across the river to Canada. They were jailed there pending two extradition requests mounted by the governor of Michigan. Sir John Colborne was lieutenant governor of Upper Canada, and he was personally an abolitionist. But there was a considerable question about whether this was going to cause a diplomatic incident of some magnitude if he did not send the Blackburns back. This is the first extradition case between Canada and the United States over the issue of Canada's reception of the fugitive slave. And what Colburn did with his Attorney General was cook up what is the first piece of public policy regarding refugee reception in Canadian history. And the decision was that they would not be able to send the Blackburns back to the United States for trial, because whether guilty or innocent of the crimes of which they were accused of inciting the riot that rescued them, they would still become slaves for life.
Right.
And that was a punishment that could not be accorded under Canadian law. Therefore, they could not be returned to the U.S. jurisdiction. That underlying policy that refugees that make it to Canadian soil will not be returned to nations where they would receive a punishment more stringent than Canadian law would allow is still the underlying spirit of Canadian refugee policy, and it started in 1833.
That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because in the evolution of those policies on the part of Canadian administrators, they were struck with a dilemma, were they not? Because they did not want to do, for the most part, anything that would enhance slavery or return a person to the condition of slavery. At the same time, they had to work out an extradition understanding that would not allow crime just to cross borders and find sanctuaries in Canada. And they did that very adroitly, I think.
Yes, it was a very carefully crafted piece of legislation, and they left a loophole in it. It was called the Offenders Law of 1833, and this was the first test case. The Blackburns were the first test case. But Sir John Colburn put in a loophole saying that no matter what the decision was, it was still up to the discretion of the lieutenant governor what the final decision would be. This was to protect fugitive slaves. That was intentionally put in to protect refugees from American bondage.
Right. I'm glad for that. I'm also glad for the point you made earlier, which we'll get into in a bit later in our conversation. That is, this book does not, I'll put it differently, the book paints a very realistic picture of the range of Canadian attitudes, because we see some very wonderful humanistic attitudes taken by those in power. But there is a degree of Canadian racism, I think, that fugitive slaves and others would have to deal with in Canada then and later. Carolyn, give us a sense of the sort of phenomena the Underground Railroad was. And then let me cite a few of the characteristics I caught from the book and have you expand on them. First of all, I think you make a point that for the most part, among these thousands of people, most of them went alone and unaided north to Canada. And one of the largest motivations, other than fleeing the awful horrors of slavery itself, was the bonds of personal affection. That is, uniting couples that had been at least married in spirit and wanted to be married and also free at the same time. So give us a sense of, you know, what were these people like, what motivated them, and what kind of encouragement did they get as they tried to make this perilous journey northward?
You touched on two of the main themes in the book, actually. The first one, I think, is that the Underground Railroad, and this is not to take away from the organized system that really did exist, and there were conductors and station masters and the whole system that really did exist, but the vast majority of people, if you read the fugitive slave narratives, got away completely alone, very often helped along the way by what I call the kindness of strangers. The chance, very often from free black communities in the northern states, particularly Ohio and Michigan, for instance, Pennsylvania, we have this image of the Underground Railroad with the kindly white Quakers helping the poor fugitive slaves. And I have tremendous trouble with that image. Certainly the Quakers were leaders in the movement, but I think that the free black people who helped risked far more than their white counterparts in assisting fugitive slaves on the Underground Railroad. The second point that comes through in the narratives, and I've read, I think, all of the available narratives from Canada, is that more than the lash and the paddle, more than starvation, more than enforced labor, more than all the terrible things that slavery did to people, the reason why people ran, the last straw for most people was the separation of their families. The black family was never safe under slavery. Wives were sold from husbands, babies from their mothers, elderly parents from their children, and that there was no control over nothing they could do. And that was very often the last straw for everyone who ran. I'm not saying every person who left because of that, but it was very, very strong piece. You know, the term sold down the river means betrayal in our English language today. It was coined in Kentucky because Kentucky slaves were worth far more in the vast markets of the Deep South than they were in Kentucky or Virginia, for instance. And so to be sold down the river meant to be sold away from one's family and friends, down the Ohio, down the Mississippi, to those great cotton markets in New Orleans and Natchez under the hill.
Boy, lots of things to comment on that. And Carolyn, let me pick up on that point of sold down the river, because again, the story of Thornton and Lucy is at the heart of everything that you've just said in this entire book, and we sort of go out in concentric circles from there and experience and encounter all these other aspects of it. When Thornton's beloved Ruthie is sold to McKnight, I believe, her new owner, she's a very lovely young woman. I think one can speculate quite responsibly that it's his fear of her being either abused by McKnight, which is almost a certainty, I would think, or, quote, sold down the river. This was a horrible prospect indeed. There's a quote, I want to bring this right up now because I think it poignantly adds to what you just said about the fears that people would have. This is from Frederick Douglass himself. It figures in the book. And I love just these few words. They sum it up, the whole horror. It's, quote, slavery did away with fathers. You know, so a slave, and I think the official American legal definition of the time said slaves had no rights that a white man was obliged to respect. So, you know, families were, you could not sustain a family in any real sense as a slave.
That was the Dred Scott decision, actually. That's what that said. But the idea, and the idea that slavery did away with fathers comes from the concept that the child of the mother followed the condition of the mother.
Exactly.
Therefore, if a mother was a slave, the child was a slave, and that child would belong to the mother's owner.
Mm-hmm. There are some additional things that would make life in Kentucky of that time, although the Kentuckians, I think, Carolyn, you're pointing out, were arguing that they had a quote, milder brand of slavery than other regions, but of course, that's quite a claim. But among the additional things that were going on to make slavery harsher everywhere that this book brings out and would have affected Thornton and Lucy as well was what we might call the triple effect, that is to say, of the fugitive slave laws, the invention of the cotton gin, and the Louisiana Purchase, all of which I think was making this a very intensely uncomfortable situation at the time that they took their action.
Well, yes, and the abolition of the Atlantic slave trade, of course, which occurred almost simultaneously. Mm-hmm. 1807 is celebrating the abolition of the British slave trade in the Atlantic, and I think 1808 here. But the ending of the Atlantic slave trade meant the domestic slave market escalated. Mm-hmm. Slaves were worth more and more and more who were born and brought up on American soil because there weren't the slaves coming in from elsewhere to replenish the supply, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Consequently, as King Cotton grew and as cotton growing land expanded into the Louisiana Purchase areas and on into Texas, the value of those slaves escalated. Thornton Blackburn was worth about $600 in Kentucky in 1833, or 1831, I'm sorry, when he escaped. The same healthy young man who could work the fields or take care of horses, whatever, in 1855 would have been worth $1,600.
Goodness.
And in modern money, we're talking, multiply by 12 or 14 for that. So.
Yeah. When they decide to leave Kentucky together, the plot gets very intense. And it is a plot because they have to sort of present themselves, disguise themselves as a, quote, free couple. With forged documents, trying to make it across the river, and you know this river is quite a symbol too. On one side, we had slaveholding Kentucky, and then I guess it's Indiana on the other side, with some degree of freedom at least, and then the prospect of Detroit, and then on to Canada. All of which they make in a very tense kind of journey. And when they get to Detroit, you mentioned this earlier. I'd love to get you to expand on this because this is one of the points I found most remarkable in the book. In the little bit that we're given to know about this period, even in America, in terms of American history, at least in popular knowledge, we rarely see the slaves as agents of their own freedom. I mean, they're sort of passive victims or people being helped or by well, I don't doubt well-intentioned other people, but here in Detroit, the depictions of those who helped make their escape from that very tense situation where they're imprisoned, I found remarkable. Slaves, black people, taking responsibility for themselves in a very striking way.
Well, I'll take you back a step and say that I believe that black Americans resisted slavery every day of their lives from the time the first ship landed in Jamestown in 1619. I believe they resisted all the time in ways large and small. Mm-hmm. And when they had the opportunity to do so in significant ways to protect each other, such as what happened in Detroit, the black community said that if the Blackburns were sent back to slavery in Kentucky, they would burn the city of Detroit to the ground, and they meant it. People came in not just from Detroit, but from all over Michigan territory. They filtered into Detroit, and over the 3 days that the Blackburns were jailed, waiting to go back to Kentucky on a steamboat, they even came across the river. Now, many of the people who had been across the river in Canada, this is across the Detroit River in Upper Canada, were fugitive slaves themselves. Mm-hmm. By stepping on American soil, they were risking their own freedom again.
That's precisely so. Mm-hmm.
What a story. I mean, and this is all true. This is all documented in court records. It's documented in the extradition documents. Mm-hmm. Their escape up the river is documented in court records because the captain of the ship was prosecuted for their escape.
It's Captain Corrier.
Captain Corrier. Mm-hmm. And that court case went on for 15 years. There mm-hmm. are just tons of documents.
You know, it's interesting about that court case and the persecution of the Blackburns, in the sense that the Oldhams, Judge Oldham, mm-hmm. I believe, and another fellow's name escapes me at the moment, but they kept trying to get them back. I mean, the pursuit mm-hmm. was fierce, and you know, and as you point out, their economic value to the slaveholders has certainly increased. But it seems to me there was something even deeper, a deeper reason for these men trying so hard to get the Blackburns returned to slavery in Kentucky. Do you agree with that?
There was a whole propaganda that had to do with people being happy in their chains, first of all, and secondly, that black people couldn't take care of themselves if they weren't enslaved. John C. Calhoun said that this was the best condition Africans had ever seen themselves in, was being enslaved, because it was the best conditions they'd ever had. How stunningly insulting. Mm-hmm. Every time a slave escaped, every time they reached a freer place and did well, started a business, had a good job, raised a healthy family, started a church, they were blowing that propaganda right out of the water.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's why slaveholders chased. I mean, certainly there was the financial reason, but John Pope Oldham spent way more than Thornton and Mrs. Blackburn's value on trying to get them back.
I appreciate that, because as I read this book, I said, you know what had to be at the heart of this? And a lot of those statements from Calhoun and others in this book are absolutely maddening, even today, to read them. It's terribly insulting, is too mild a term. But they had to defend, I think this is what you've just said even more eloquently, an ideology of inequality.
Yes.
At the same time, they had this then so-called democracy, and that these people were only capable of mm-hmm. existing in that situation, and they were essentially being done a favor. I mean, it's a really extraordinary thing. Anyway, by the time that Thornton and Lucy and the many others who mm-hmm. make this same journey we're talking about get into Canada, they began to do things on Canadian soil that powerfully disprove all of this. And I'd love for you to talk about the aftermath, that is to say the Blackburns now settled in Canada, mm-hmm. and the entrepreneurial spirit that is reflected not just in what they did, but in what many of the others African-American slaves did as they came into Canada at that time.
The vast majority ended up in rural communities, which is not what the Blackburns did, but mm-hmm. the vast majority ended up in rural communities because they wanted to own their own land. Mm-hmm. They had been working land for generations that they could never own. And the idea of independent land ownership was very important. So there were fugitive slave colonies in southwestern Ontario, a number of them, including one at Buxton, for instance, which is still a descendant community of considerable significance, Dresden also. Those communities were very successful, people got self-governing communities. But there were a lot of people that had urban skills, like the Blackburns. Mm-hmm. And they went to Toronto, the largest city in Upper Canada. They started the first taxi business in Upper Canada, which was a form of independence also.
Right.
The Blackburns never learned to read and write, but they ran a successful cab business, which other people emulated very quickly. The Toronto newspapers, people were complaining that their coachmen were quitting to start their own taxi businesses because then they'd be independent and earn their own money. Mm-hmm. The Blackburns also contributed, as did many, many of the other former fugitives and free black people who moved to Canada also. There were a lot of free people who came as well from the cities of the north and the south, who came in search of the right to own land, vote, raise their children in freedom, serve mm-hmm. on juries, and all those things that were not possible in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. They contributed to the development of self-help organizations, benevolent organizations, fraternal organizations, and particularly anti-slavery organizations.
Right. And I can't help but remember now, as you say all that, at the time of his death, Lucy was somewhat older than Thornton, I believe.
9 years.
9 years. He left an estate of something like $18,000 mm-hmm. in the currency of that time, which was quite significant, mm-hmm. and had owned several properties in Toronto, had become mm-hmm. a man of means. It's a remarkable story in that light, but also remarkable, Carolyn, is the fact that you do not shy away from revealing some of the challenges they faced in Canada, mm-hmm. because there was a significant degree of racism mm-hmm. that they had to overcome in Canada. And I'd love to get you to speak to this, because this is one of the paradoxes I was left with as the book comes into its final chapters. At the time of the Civil War, mm-hmm. the Canadian attitudes, there was a powerful pro-union faction,
yes,
powerful anti-slavery faction, but I was floored by what seemed to be a substantial Confederate support as well in mm-hmm. Canada. I mean, how did that all... I was dying to ask you that even as I read that coming about.
It's quite shocking to most Canadians. They're not aware of this now. Mm-hmm. There was a strong Confederate sympathy in Britain as well.
Of course. In Britain, I understood it, though, mm-hmm. it's sort of that was an economic principle. They needed this, mm-hmm. the cotton markets. And they also, of course, wanted to take a nice slap at Washington. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. in Canada...
I'm not sure there wasn't a little bit of that in Canada as well. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter was, too, that there was a sympathy for the romance of the South and that whole
concept. Gone with the Wind.
When the Battle of Bull Run was lost by the Union Army, mm-hmm. there was a cheer rose up in the Canadian Parliament. Right. The House of Parliament was stunning. And Canada received a considerable number of Confederate refugees throughout the war, including John C. Breckinridge. Mm-hmm. And Robert E. Lee visited Toronto. The number of the generals from the South and senior officers, there was a nest of Confederate spies operating out of the Queen's Hotel in Toronto. There was also a nest of Union spies mm-hmm. operating out of a hotel down the road. And this is a story that's really rarely been told.
Yeah.
And the thing that shocks me about it is that the people who had fled Kentucky, fled Virginia, fled the Carolinas, and ended up in Canada were probably walking down the street in Toronto and running into their former owners.
That's right. Yes, 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 yes. That was it. Yes, you mentioned that in the book, and that is really quite something to even contemplate. But but on balance, one must say that the book is honest about those sentiments existing, but still we had a progressive mm-hmm. and progressing African-Canadian community at this time mm-hmm. in Canada. You know, everything that we're talking about, Carolyn, this book itself, The 20-Year Obsession and everything else, begins when you excavate, as an archaeologist, mm-hmm. the site of the Blackburn home in Toronto, mm-hmm. Which... And the pictures from that, which are yeah. quite evocative too, leads me to ask, what remains of that now? I mean, not so much the physical structure, obviously, but in terms of its... Are Canadians taught about it themselves? Do they know the Blackburn story? Are the Canadian kids, black and white, growing up in Toronto these days, aware of the very ground they tread upon and who was there before them?
We're trying. We are really working on this. There is a plaque at the site of Inglenook Community School, which was where the schoolyard is actually where we did the excavation. That's mm-hmm. where the home of Thornton and Lucy Blackburn had been. And there was a commemoration. The Blackburns are now listed as persons of national historic significance by the Canadian government and of state historic significance by the state of Kentucky.
Oh.
Which is very interesting, mm-hmm. I think. And we did a double plaquing. We put a plaque up on April 26, 2002 in Louisville at the place where Thornton worked, at Wirtz and Reinhardt's dry goods store at 4th and Main in downtown Louisville. Mm-hmm. And that was a Friday. And on the Monday, the 29th, dignitaries from Kentucky, as well as Parks Canada staff and descendant community members came to Toronto, and we put a plaque up on a site there where they had lived in freedom for more than 50 years. Mm. That was the first binational commemoration of any Underground Railroad journey ever conducted between Canada and the United States. Mm. And that particular event was publicized in both countries in the national press. The Blackburns are on walking tours of Toronto. Their story is in the curriculum in the schools in Toronto. In fact, before the city amalgamated, the story of Thornton and Lucy Blackburn was the first required Black history curriculum in Toronto schools, grade mm-hmm. sixth grade curriculum. And it has been the subject of many, many talks, media pieces, we've tried very, very hard to make sure that that story is up front and center, because the Black Prince have come to symbolize Toronto's story of the Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful, because the Black Prince themselves had no issue. They had no direct descendants, right? But it's really extraordinarily wonderful, as I said, to know that that's being continued that way, being made known mm-hmm. to people. And you mentioned the descendant community, I think it was a phrase mm-hmm. you used, which I take it to be those who descended from slaves. Mm-hmm. What is that community like? Is it just very prominent in Canadian affairs today?
Canada has a very varied African-Canadian community from all over the world. There's a significant Caribbean population, mm-hmm. significant African population now. But the people whose families have been there for 5, 6, 7, 8 generations are very aware of their heritage. Communities like Buxton, which was part of the Elgin settlement, the Elgin Association settlement founded in 1849, have a museum in the community, strong, strong public presence, continual ongoing educational programming. The North American Black History Museum in Amherstburg, Ontario, Uncle Tom's Cabin in Dresden, Ontario, the Wish Center in Chatham. All of these very strong communities have a sense of their own heritage, which they transmit and share.
Carolyn, it's been wonderful talking to you about all of these matters. I mean, I obviously strongly recommend this book to everyone who's not just interested in this topic, but interested in what would I call it? I'd call this the human miracle, the miracle of being alive and surviving the various dangers and afflictions that are passed our way. It's a marvelous human story as well as a great historical story. Thank you so much, Carolyn.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Carolyn Smards Frost. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Sharana Harris, and our assistant producer is Keila Jackson. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.